Fran Lebowitz moved to New York City as a young woman, drove a cab, wrote for Andy Warhol's Interview magazine, and arrived as a writer with her books, Metropolitan Life and Social Studies. Adjectives of her opinions include trenchant, mordant, caustic, acerbic, and hilarious. Now filmmaker Martin Scorsese focuses on Fran Lebowitz in an HBO documentary called Public Speaking. In this excerpt, Toni Morrison asks her the difference between wit and humor.
Niceness. Niceness? I mean, or what people call, like, you know, warmth.
Wit.
No, comedy.
Ah, oh, I see.
Like, we have a lot of comedians.
Yeah.
Because people like comedians. People like comedians because comedians usually make fun of someone other than the person they're talking to. You know, or if they directly make fun of that person, it's in a very insulting, vulgar way. But in writing, wit is something, it's cold. It has to be cold, you know. Wit is judgment.
If you've seen Fran Lebowitz talk, what's the most interesting thing you've heard her say? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk at npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Public Speaking premieres on HBO this coming Monday on November 22nd. Fran Lebowitz joins us now from our bureau in New York, and nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And do you find that people prefer to hear you being funny or witty?
Luckily, most people don't know the difference.
You make a lot of travels around the country to talk to audiences. I heard you describe in the film that at the end of each one of these, you ask for questions from the audience, yet you say you don't actually get a lot of questions.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, because the audience has now been taught to give answers, like you just said. Would you like to tell us what you think? And so that wasn't always the case, you know, that people asked the audience what they thought. To me, the audience, there are people who come to see someone, and there are people, and then there's a person you came to see. There is some distinction to be made between these two things, perhaps?
There might be, but indeed, people like to participate these days. It's an era where, all kinds of citizen participation seems to be the rage.
Yes, except in actual citizenry. I mean, to me, there is way too much democracy in the culture and not enough in the society. A good way, for instance, to participate as a citizen would be to vote, you know, not necessarily to tell your opinion of a singer.
You also say that talking about democracy, that there is a place for, we've heard a lot of criticism these past several months in particular, of elites, yet you defend elites to the death.
Well, I defend a certain kind of elitism. In other words, when Republicans, for instance, disparage elites, they don't mean rich people. They love rich people. You know, they mean smart people. They don't mind elite athletes. They use that phrase all the time. They love elite soldiers, you know. So we know what they mean when they say elite. It's not true.
Isn't it another way of continuing the culture war that we've read about again for, well nigh into four decades?
Yeah. I mean, it's of course, if you hold the positions these people hold, you naturally would be wary of the person of intelligence because a person of intelligence can see that these positions are grotesque.
And persons of intelligence, that's defined by what, meritocracy?
It's defined by me.
Okay.
I make my own judgments.
And you stick by them?
Yes, I stick by them.
Do you find yourself to be consistent?
Yes, I find myself to be... Well, I feel I rarely change my mind. I would like to change my mind, by which I mean I would point out to me some other way of looking at it. I will listen, you know. But I would say that I rarely have to change my mind.
And you say you, in fact, get to make decisions very quickly.
Snap judgments, which is why I desperately, every time a little position opens on the Supreme Court, I really wish they would choose me.
All of the boroughs of New York seem to be represented at this point, except for maybe Staten Island.
Yes, I know. But I'm available because I, many years ago, discovered that you do not have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court. And since I am already not a lawyer, I thought, I'm available.
And your snap judgment decision, you would think, would add to the deliberations of the
I do. I don't know why they deliberate, because almost everything in front of the Supreme Court is very easy to figure out.
Really?
It's not complicated. Yes, it is not complicated. We have, a constitution, you know, which is incredibly clear. You know, it's a wonderful piece of prose on top of everything else. So I understand what are they thinking about.
Well, you're not a judge, but you do play one on TV, or did from time to time.
I did, yes. But, of course, unfortunately, Law and Order was canceled. I played an arraignment judge. I was a recurring arraignment judge. And when I did that, a lot of people said to me, friend, are you doing that little part because you're hoping to get a bigger part? And I said, no, I'm playing a judge because I'm hoping to become an actual judge. But it didn't work out.
It didn't. How did they approach you for that? I mean, how did you get the part?
I begged for the part. I mean, I would say that, I have a friend, Peyton Murkison, who's on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept asking her, you know, can I be a judge? Can I be a judge? And they actually gave me an audition to be a judge. And I actually failed the audition because the initial part was a real judge, by which I mean the trial judge, and that's too much acting. So as I was failing the audition, I said at the end of it, look, I know I did a horrible job. I failed the audition. It's just too much for me. Can I just be an arraignment judge? And the producer said, Fran, actors don't say, I know I failed the audition, so can I have a smaller part? I said, yes, I know, but I'm not an actor. So that's how I got the part.
That's how you got the part. And yes. Recurring, what, two, three times a year?
Yeah, a couple times a year.
Yeah. And they always give you very good lines.
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, the writers, of whom, of course, there are many, I think they enjoyed, you know, that little part.
You've also not only played the judge you say one of the things you talk about in the film was the movie options that were thrown your way after Metropolitan Life came out, what, back in 1978?
In 78, yeah. Yes, there was a tremendous amount of interest to buy the book, which was a book of essays. I wouldn't sell it because it was, a book of essays. And I knew that they would do, you know, horrible things with it, as they tend to do. And unlike many of my fellow writers, I know the difference between, you know, sell, you know, and rent. So I never had any compassion for writers who complained about what they did to their work because that's what buy means. But I didn't want to do it to mine. And the truth is, even during periods of tremendous personal poverty, I've never regretted that decision.
Yet, as I'm sure many other writers have told you, one of the best ways to guarantee a movie is not being made of your work is to sell the rights to a studio.
I understand that, but I don't have that kind of good luck. Like, if they would promise to say, we're going to pay you all this money, we're not going to make the movie, we promise, okay.
In fact, there's another point in the film, and this goes back. There's some old tape of you from years ago where you talk about the difference between writing for a living and not writing for a living.
Because that's a piece that was in my second book, Social Studies.
Yes.
That was from my experience of having had the first book come out. Yes, I noted that I was being offered when I say a great deal more, I mean, like, by, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars more for books or movies or whatever that I had not written than for all the things I had actually written previous to that.
We're talking with Fran Lebowitz, the author and speaker, about the HBO film made by Martin Scorsese about her. It's called Public Speaking, and it debuts next week. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Charlie's on the line calling from Wyoming in Michigan.
Yes, Neil, thank you for taking my call. I would like to say I love it when you laugh and talk. That just gets me laughing as well.
So,
I just think you do a great job with that, and I love your show.
Oh, well, thanks very much. Charlie, were you talking about me laughing and talking or Fran Lebowitz laughing and talking?
I was talking about Liam Neeson or how I don't know how you pronounce her name.
Lebowitz.
Lebowitz. I was actually talking about her.
Okay.
About how she laughs and talks. It just makes me laugh, and I can't stop laughing when I hear her laugh.
Fran Lebowitz, have you ever been complimented on your laugh before?
I can't say I have. I definitely not that I can recall, you know. But perhaps I have suddenly developed an infectious laugh.
It can come late in life and transform everything.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
I suppose so. How did you find out that Martin Scorsese wanted to make a film about you?
He told me. It was very direct. I've known Marty for a long time. And this idea of doing this movie was originally Graydon Carter's idea that he wanted to make a documentary about me. I said no, because I didn't want anyone to follow me around. I do seem to be the only person in the country of whom that is true. And then he said, Marty, and, you know, you can't say no. I mean, or I could not say no to Marty. And I knew that Marty wouldn't do something that, you know, conventional and that I wouldn't have to worry about it.
Some of the cuts in this film, I'm assuming you've seen it.
I have seen this movie 7 times, and I've seen 7 different movies. But the one that you saw is the last one. That's the final one.
And some of the cuts are extraordinarily seamless. Cuts from a conversation with you recorded in a booth. Is that at Elaine's?
No, it's in the Waverly Inn.
In the Waverly Inn, okay. And then they cut to performances that you do on stage or interviews, including the one by Toni Morrison we played a clip from earlier, that are just extraordinary the way they move right from one to the other.
Well, you know, Marty is really coming along, isn't he? and he has there's, you know, 2 editors on the movie, and they're fantastically talented. Yes, I had no compunction at all about working with these people.
Fran Lebowitz, the author and essayist, the subject of the new documentary, Public Speaking, premieres on HBO November 22nd. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go next to Rona. Rona with us from Marble Canyon in Arizona.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Rona. Go ahead, please.
Fran, did you write an article for Vogue or somebody that said, if I were king?
Yes, a long time ago.
I loved it.
Thank you. But you see, I'm still not the king.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. I'm not either.
It matters to me.
But I always, well, you know, I can be king in my own place, right? In my own head.
Yes,
and
but that's insufficient.
And I use that all the time.
Well, for me, that's insufficient because I'm greedy for power.
Ah, well.
How do you?
If I needed that, I wouldn't be living in Marble Canyon. Well, you make me laugh, you make me smile, you make me feel good about what's in my head.
Well.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And how is your campaign for King going?
Very poorly.
No subjects yet?
No. Well, you know, not enough that you could call them subjects. Perhaps objects.
Objects. Yes. Well, plenty of objects in your life, I suspect. Though you live in New York City, your apartment can't probably hold that many objects.
Well, most of the objects I own are books, and I just moved a few months ago. And in this move, I discovered that I had 8,500 books. And so that's really enough objects for anyone.
Did you, in the process of moving, did you wean some of them and get rid of them?
Yes, that's why I ended up with only 8,500.
I see. So some of the others have gone to the Strand or some other worthy...
Yes, to the Strand, yes.
The famous bookstore in downtown Manhattan. And I assume you still live in Manhattan.
I do.
Even though, as you point out, Manhattan has become, well, rather Disney-fied, I think is the expression we use today.
Well, it's become very suburban. You know, I mean, I know that's hard for people to believe who live in, I guess, Wyoming, the last person called. So I'm not saying it's not Wyoming. It has become more suburban because we have a suburban mayor.
Mayor Bloomberg, who's...
Yes, Mayor Bloomberg, who is his king.
Yes, he is, but he got there another way. He just made billions.
No, he got there another way. He overturned an election.
Let's go to Carrie. Carrie with us from Tucson, which is also not suburbs.
Hi, Ms. Lebowitz. I want to say thank you. I read Metropolitan Life when I was only 12 years old. And on my first train ride from my divorcing mother's house to my divorcing father's house in the city of Chicago, and I remember laughing out loud at the child food critic who says, Mommy, the carrot sticks were delicious. And I remember thinking, wow, this is great. This is a possibility. This is a possibility for me. And years later, I grew up to become an artist, but as a diversion, I started a comic essay group with my now ex-husband here in Tucson. So I just want to say thank you. I'm thrilled to be able to talk to you somewhat directly. And thank you so much. You really inspired me.
I wrote that book when I was 12.
But did you ever consider the effect you would have on children?
No, it never crossed my mind.
Well, I didn't. I suspect that you knew that you had some 12-year-old fans, but... Now at 49, I can finally say thank you. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Carrie, thanks very much. I did want to ask you about one point, I think a serious point you make in the film, and that is the result of the AIDS epidemic, which, as you point out correctly, cost us many wonderful artists, but you also point out it cost us an audience.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I say in the movie is that it is not just the artists who died of AIDS, at the time when everyone died all at once. But it was also the audience for those artists, which was an extremely discerning audience, which is essential, in fact, to an artist. The audience that an artist has, whether there's readers or whatever, if they're really discerning, makes that artist better. And if they are people who leap up and give standing ovations to every single person who walks on the stage, you know, the culture is worse. You know, the audience is just as important to the culture as the artist is, just the way that the citizen is just as important as a president is.
And can you tell us, obviously this film appears next week, what are you working on?
I'm working on getting people to watch this film.
Well, we knew that, but we thank you very much for your time today. Good luck with that, and we hope it goes well and you find something else to do next week.
Well, thank you very much.
Fran Lebowitz joined us from our bureau in New York. The film that is made about her, called Public Speaking, appears on HBO next week on November 22nd, and she was with us from our bureau in New York. Before we go, Patti Smith, the musician, is now Patti Smith, the award-winning author. She received the National Book Award for Nonfiction last night in New York. The book Just Kids, her memoir about life in New York in the 1960s. We talked with Patti Smith late last year about her career and her life. You can find that online at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Tomorrow, Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here with a look at the Xbox Kinect and how it tracks your moves. Could this sort of motion sensing technology revolutionize desktop computing as well? We'll be back on Monday. We'll see you then. Have a great weekend, everybody. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.